specifically what I've learned in the last 3 years about aging is that aging is a stage of life that has its own unique characteristics, and that it is possible, because of the conditions that you find yourself in, to do some really interesting inner work. So you use your experience of awakening as a vehicle, you use your experience of aging as a vehicle for awakening. And the more awakened you are, the more your experience of aging becomes one that is quite a delight, even when it's heavy and dark. You learn how to use the shadows as vehicles for awakening. And the biggest shadow is the shadow surrounding death. And you learn how to be with death without a lot of religious belief overlay, just be with death as the mystery of the universe. And you start to see that what you're doing as you get older and approach death is you are approaching the doorway into the mystery. And you ask yourself, how would I like to approach a mystery? By denial? Or would I like to approach the mystery with clarity of mind, with a sense of adventure, with being as little trapped in the stuff that's holding me back where I was because of where I could be going? If you look at our rituals for dying in our society, you will see how much they're oriented towards this side and how little they're oriented to across the other side. I had an extraordinary experience. Some of you may know this, but when Polly Klass died, her mother asked me to be part of the memorial service. And I went up thinking I was going to be with a few ministers or something running the service, and there was CNN and the whole thing, and the governor and the senators and the whole business. And so I was last, after all the machas spoke. And it was fascinating to me that by the time I spoke, nobody yet had even dealt with the fact that Polly was a being in a different state of consciousness. They all were so busy reacting to the way she died. So they were all, I mean, Davis got more billing than Polly got at her funeral. And I got up and I said, look, just here we are surrounding this being with some love. Let us bring her into mind and be with her and, you know, just allow, because, lots more, but questions. And I'll repeat the questions. And you can ask about anything, by the way. You can be hostile if you want. Yeah. I'll love you anyway. I don't care. It's your hostility, not mine.
I'd like to know your conception of God.
He would like to know my conception of God. Well, God is not a concept, for starters. Okay. There is a sutra in the Tibetan tradition, the Heart Sutra, that says form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And in that way, for me, God is the formless, unmanifest, that contains everything. And it is also the manifestation of what this is. So for me, it's all God. It's all God. It's the play of God, including me. And so the tricky issue is that in the Judeo-Christian tradition, what I just said to you was a mystic statement, and mysticism is heresy. It is chutzpah, because it implies that you think you're God. And I would say, if you said to me, am I God? I'd say, yes, and so are you. It's nothing special with me. The manifestation, I mean, you arrive at stages of consciousness where you are so awestruck by the infinite beauty of all of it, even the most horrible of it. And you look with awe, and it's the awful stage. You know? So I stand in awe of God. I can't do much better than that. Yes.
So then why is there a need to label it as God?
Why is there a need to label it as God? Well, it's a finger pointing at the moon, so we will recognize there is a moon, and we'll turn our heads and look, that's all. When you take human beings and they start to transform, what they have available to them is a whole history of working with relationship. They have a ability to relate to mother, to. And so you can use that relational heart quality, that emotional relational thing, as a stepladder to climb into a more and more intimate relationship with the beloved. So you use the concept of God to go beyond the concept of God. The concept of God is like the concept of the beloved. It is of other. And you keep having the foreplay with other until finally the moment comes when other is no longer other. And that's what that dance of mystical awakening is about, from my point of view, what I am experiencing. Questions? Excuse me? Yes. Yeah? Excuse me? He had a what, the size of grapefruit?
A cancer.
A what?
A cancer.
Oh.
A cancer, the size of the grapefruit?
Not that I know of.
Someone that she knew in India.
Yeah.
Not even Maharaji, but it was someone that was very close to you that said that it felt like 1,000 scorpions biting him at the same time.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yeah. I remember the image, yes. Wouldn't forget that image. The things of this plane are incredibly seductive to be treated as real. And things we want and things we don't want. And certain kinds of strong stimulation we don't want. And we push against them. We call it pain. And we push against it, and we build up a kind of an us-them relationship to the pain. And my best understanding of that is that using your mind to push against the pain exacerbates the suffering involved. It increases the suffering involved. And there are some absolutely beautiful meditations around working with pain in the sense of starting to open and soften and almost embrace into yourself. And just continually working with them, because what they are strong stimuli that you push against, and that pushing against creates incredible agitation and sadness and everything in you. So there are these meditations in which you keep softening and meeting and opening and embracing. Now, I have not had chronic pain, but I have had things like kidney stones or hepatitis, which have been intense pain for a moment. And I saw that as long as I didn't know what it was, my mind had this fear that I was doing the wrong thing. There was something I could do about it. And that kept me off balance. The minute I heard, okay, it's a stone, it may pass, and if not, da, 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 da. The minute I realized it was hepatitis and it would run its course, it would either kill me or not, but it would run its course, there was something in me that just relaxed and started to open to the experience of the moment, of which the pain was a part. But it wasn't by any means all of it, just a part of it. And I saw that there's a beautiful image of Ramana Maharshi dying of a cancerous shoulder, which is a lot of pain in the way his shoulder was disintegrating. And they wanted to give him medication. He says, no, it's not bothering me. What I see is that as you work with your consciousness, like what I was talking about being with somebody with something like cancer or AIDS or Lou Gehrig disease or whatever, if you focus on the symptom, which we are really good at in this culture, the pain, what you end up doing is staying stuck in that reality. When I go in, I'm meeting a fellow being who is going through a different process than I'm going through at that moment. And we explore what the process looks like. What that does is, for example, if you and I talk about your pain, we'll see that who I'm talking to is not the same person who's experiencing the pain. And that's part of what happens. The witness or the mindfulness, like somebody comes to me and they say, I'm depressed. I say, you're really depressed? Yeah. Everywhere you're depressed? Yes. There's no corners, no. I'm really depressed. I said, is who's telling me he's depressed, depressed? No, I'm just telling you. Well, let me talk to that person. I mean, I'm being cute, but it's very true that it is possible to meet a person in a plane of consciousness. Just like when you dream at night, you could be in excruciating pain and you wake up and you say, it was just a dream. There's a flip of consciousness right there. You can train yourself to do that. Pain exists on one plane, on one channel. It does not exist on all channels. And you can work with it differently. And so you end up letting all your suffering, like all that pain, be the vehicle for you to keep extricating your awareness from identification with your own sensations, not by pushing them away or denying them, but just by cultivating mindfulness and appreciation and awareness of the situation. Just keep coming back into the moment with awareness. Yes. That what? I think Dr. Kevorkian is a symbol of a dilemma that we find ourselves in. And the question is, see, I'm a great advocate of the freedom of consciousness. I don't think a government or the well-meaningness of anybody else has a right to tell me what I can do with my consciousness. You know, they can imprison my body, but they can't get my consciousness. And in a way, I feel that I'd like to have control of the decision when I decide to die. And I found that with people that are dying, there are two things that reduce the suffering they have during dying. One is the feeling that they can control their own medication. And the second is that they feel that if it got too much, they could stop it. They may never do it, but they feel they could. And I am not ready to take away either of those things from human beings. Now, Dr. Kevorkian is a pawn in the game. I mean, he's doing it in a certain way. He's doing it because of that right he feels people have to say enough. And he's using his role to do that. I would not like to die in Dr. Kevorkian's trailer, but I would but I would like to, if I hope to have enough wisdom and control to be able to create a scene that I would like to die in, that would help me move towards death rather than pushing always against it. Because, yeah. Is that dealing with your question at all?
Yeah. Okay.
Sir, yes? Way down at the end, yes. How do you manage not to cling to your aversions? By cultivating mindfulness about them. See, there is an aversion, like, I don't like that. I hear myself say, I don't like that. Now, I've trained myself, for example, to, when I find myself in my judging mind, which is, I don't like it, aversions and attractions are judging minds. I like that, I don't like that, etc. I've trained myself now as a practice to immediately shift into the appreciative mind. So, I don't like that. Wow, look at that. Isn't that the most essence scoundrel you've ever met? It's that quality. It's just the flip of consciousness so that you're starting to work with it, so it becomes workable a little bit. So I would say you work with your aversions, you can't deny them, but you bring them into the clarity of your conscious awareness. And then in that clarity, something changes. Because in that clarity, you begin to sense how that got to be and where it fits in the whole web of things, and out of that comes some response that might be different. See, the quality of bringing awareness back, extricating itself from senses and thought, not to deny them, but just not to be trapped exclusively in them, is that your awareness comes back and you begin to see the whole scene, including yourself, as a gestalt, as a total scene, rather than in linear pieces. And in that, you begin to sense the deeper harmonies or rhythms of which you are a part. And it starts to change. And you see that it wasn't worth holding onto that aversion. It's not interesting enough. The more you stand back, the more those aversions and attractions start to fall away. There's a great story that I've been loving telling. It's about a gentleman like me who's walking down the street and he hears somebody say, "Psst, could you help me out?" And he looks around and there's nobody there. So he goes to walk on and he hears, "Psst, could you help me out?" And he looks around and there's nobody there. But then he looks down and there is a large frog. Now, this is not a man that speaks to frogs, but there's only him and the frog, and he clearly heard somebody say, "Could you help me out?" So he finds himself embarrassedly saying, "Did you speak to me?" And the frog said, "Yes, could you help me out?" So the man says, "Well, what do you want?" And the frog says, "Well, I'm under a curse, and if you will kiss me, I will turn into such a beautiful maiden and I will make your life so happy and I will make a warm home and a warm bed for you and it will be so lovely." The man stood there for a moment and then he picked up the frog and he put it in his pocket and he walked on. And after a while, from the pocket, he heard, "Hey, you forgot to kiss me." And the man said, "You know, at my age, I think it's more interesting to have a talking frog." There's a change of attraction. Sir?
How do we parents teach, be with our children in a way that enables them to go through somebody training without getting lost and coming out the other end without an education?
He's asking, how do you be a parent without trapping your child in their roles? And the answer is, by you not being trapped in yours. So you end up working on yourself as your gift to your child. Because to the extent you see yourself as a soul who fulfills roles, including fatherdom, you can be with your child as a soul who is fulfilling childdom. And you can interact and be impeccable as father and child without being trapped by it. And you can keep meeting behind the game. And it's never too early to do that. In fact, the earlier you start, the more it's obvious. I mean, my cat and I, we live behind the game because there's no game. I mean, the game is obvious. It's cat food and stuff, but... So we don't waste much time on that stuff. We just hang out together. It's not all the clutter of thinking mind. Yes, ma'am.
My father is dying of Alzheimer's.
Yes. What kind of pain are you mean? Physical pain. Okay. Physical pain. Yeah, physical pain. It comes back to the same thing again, that what you can offer him is being with him as a fellow being and not getting trapped in your mind in the model of him as somebody with Alzheimer's or somebody with all the collapsed vertebrae. Your seeing that keeps making that real in your relationship. And there is another way the two of you can be together. And when he tastes this other way, the natural relaxation will come and the ease of dropping it all away. So what you do is, again, you work on yourself as your gift to your father. And you get so that your models about how it should be. There's an incredible film that you may have seen. It's called Confessions of a Dutiful Daughter. It's put out by the Alzheimer's Foundation. And what it shows is the mother who, with Alzheimer's, who a lot of the pain of the whole situation was created by the daughter's inability to allow the consciousness of the mother to be everywhere at once. And once the daughter relaxed, the last scene is like the mother walking down the corridor of the nursing home, swinging her pocketbook with a penny in it, saying, "I'm free, I'm free, I'm free." And it was the daughter that had to let go in that case. Now, I thought how idealistic that model is, because there are a lot of people, Alzheimer's is a very complicated situation, because as the controls of the mind relax, a person can be going into other planes of consciousness and doing wonderful inner work, if there is nobody around bringing them back into linearity all the time. However, often what it does is uncovers really kind of dark stuff in people. One woman who's been a very dear friend for many years has been 54 years married to a man who's got quite advanced Alzheimer's, and she's had him at home, enjoyed being with him and taking care and doing all of that stuff and enjoying the companionship. And then I got a message that he was in a home, a nursing care unit. And I was surprised. When I talked to her, I said, "What happened?" And she said, "Well, he woke up one night and he said, 'Get out of bed.' He said, 'A man shouldn't sleep with a sister.'" Okay, so I said, "All right." And then the next one was, he started to climb out the window. And she said, "Why are you climbing out the window?" He says, "Because the madam of this brothel is making me sleep with 19 girls." And she said, "Here, let me help you back in," because it was the 7th floor. And he said, "Don't get near me, you're the madam." Now that's deeper psychological stuff that's coming up as the controls loosen. And that can be really hard to deal with, as you can imagine. And that comes up a lot too. So you have to listen in your heart, but you listen to see that your mind isn't holding. So that the person, because what I see is even the people that weren't spiritually trained to see the journey as a one of awakening. As they approach death through suffering, the suffering keeps doing something to them, and there is a process of the turning of consciousness that happens, and where there can be going on to other planes, and this plane just isn't that relevant to them. And for us to say that's wrong, why? Maybe that's their work. I mean, I really realized that I had no moral right to define what a good death was. You know, because each person had to go through what they had to go through. How presumptuous of me to think I had a model of how people should die. All I can say is if I am dying, I would like to be clear in my consciousness. I would like to feel love and loved and adventurous and be supported, and I would like all of that, yes, and be ready to answer the mystery. Sir.
Can you speak a little bit about your relationship with Dr. Leary in the last couple of years?
Well, I've just had a really an extraordinary privilege of being with him through the processes of his dying. Tim has just recently died, as many of you probably know, of cancer of the prostate that metastasized throughout his body. He's asking about Timothy Leary. Timothy and I were very different kinds of people, although our history threw us together at a critical moment in our lives. Timothy was, he loved the play of the mind. He loved it. And I, almost from the beginning of my psychedelic stuff that he introduced me to, was very, very drawn to emptiness, to the unformed, to the one behind the many. And Tim was absolutely entranced by the many, by the play of form. So as years went by, I started to build a whole universe around my mystical orientation, and he built a great one around his visionary mind work. So when it came to dying, he called me and he said, "Richard, I've got great news, I'm dying." I said, "That's wonderful." And what he planned to do, and he had all of these cyber people in his home, he was downloading himself onto his webpage, because if you're a philosophical materialist, what do you save? What do you want to do? You want to make yourself immortal through, if you are only information, put it all on the webpage, and then you exist in virtual reality even if you're not around. And then he was also, he had made a deal with cryonics to freeze his brain, which is the other thing a philosophical materialist would do. So I had grave concern about this. I thought, Timothy is in some kind of denial. But I go into this house, and everybody was in cyberland, and nobody was dying. So, I mean, what am I going to do? Come in and say, "Hey, cut it out. We're all dying." You know, nobody was asking me, so it was none of my business. So I go out and hang out, and we'd have a great time together. And Tim was making a very interesting social statement at the same time, because if you notice, Newsweek and CNN and all those places listed the medicines he was taking every day, which was whiskey and joints and nitrous oxide and Dilaudids, and he was making a statement saying medication should be used at the time of dying to relieve pain, to optimize consciousness, and to have fun. And you can feel how alien that last one feels in our culture. Have fun? Dying? How obscene. Why? So he was making an interesting statement. So he knew that, I mean, he and I had disagreed for years about the universe. And so he called me and he says, "Richard," this is great, he said, "Richard," this was a few days before he died, he said, "Richard, I think I'm losing my memory." I said, "Yep." And he says, "You know," he says, "memory is nearly everything." See, that's exactly what he thinks, isn't it? See? I said, "Yep." He says, "But you know, there's something more than memory." I said, "Oh?" He said, But I forgot. So I kept going down to Hollywood to visit, and it was a great, he ran a salon until he died, actually, for the last few days. And so I was still full of my psychological, as a psychologist, you know, denial, I've got to help him. I'll be here when it hits the fan, you know. When his mind starts to dissolve, because he's all in his mind and he's going to get frightened when it's, you know. But at one moment, we sat at a table and we looked in one of his eyes, and he was back in there so deep. He was so little connected with the storyline that at that moment I felt a complete release of any doubt I had. This was an adventurer who was as ready for this moment as anybody I'd ever met. And so, go with God, you know. Great, Tim. Great trip. Questions? Yes. Well, to the extent that the ego is a software in the computer, and this computer all gets either burned or eaten by ants, it's hard to figure what it is that's hanging around. The minute you allow that there's something that isn't that kind of energy, that doesn't get transformed at the moment of death, then you say, well, what is that? And that's where I'm just using that as an articulation of that's what soul is. So that what happens is that who you think you are and how you think it was goes, but the deeper who you are that determined who you think you are is there, which is the soul has its own uniqueness. It has its own, what I'd call karma or psychic DNA or whatever you want to call, something that has continuity to it. So when you die, now what happens, I suspect, I don't know. That's why it's a mystery. I don't know either. There's a great Zen story of a Zen student saying to the master, "Master, tell me, what happens after death?" Master says, "I don't know." Student says, "But you're a Zen master." Master says, "But I'm not a dead Zen master." So I don't know. All of the near-death literature and all of the stuff that I've studied would lead me to suspect that when a soul gets disengaged from a body with which it has very strongly identified with, there is incredible confusion for it at that moment, because it can't imagine it still exists when it doesn't have that. So it assumes, since it still exists, that it didn't die. But it did die. So one of the things that's nice to reassure good philosophical materialists when they die is that they're dead. You know, light a candle and say, "Hey, you did it, you're finished, you're free. You made it, you're through, you're okay, relax, it's okay." You know? People that are more evolved, that are more conscious, I mean, the most conscious beings say, "Come by for tea next Tuesday, I'm going to drop my body." And then you have tea and they turn around three times, sit down and leave. And they say, "Well, dropping the body, finish that course." You know, finished neurosis 204, I'm going on to something else now. I'm playing with it, but it's a mystery. And all I have a sense is that uniqueness transcends death, but that personality, as it's manifested in its grosser form, and the body don't. Okay? So if you think of your personality, you'll be surprised. Okay? Suicide. Well, come back to the issue of aversion and attraction. In most of the traditions, of the mystic traditions. It says that if at the moment of death you are pushing against something or grabbing something, it propels you into more stuff. And if the game is to extricate yourself from stuff, to be in God, to be one with all things, then you would want to approach death with the minimum of attraction or aversion. So that what when a Tibetan Lama says, come by Thursday, and he turns three times and dies, you could say that's a suicide. But you and I both hear that what he is saying is, this is the moment when it is time and appropriate to drop the body, and I'm doing that. Somebody else says, I can't stand it anymore, I can't stand it anymore, the pain is too great, and pushes against it. That aversion, there's no ill, there's no evil, it's not bad, it's the predicament all of us are in this room at this moment. We all died last time, if you want a reincarnational model, we all died last time with still some stuff to do. And when the Buddha says, well, how long does this go on? The Buddha said, he said, imagine a mountain 6 miles long, 6 miles wide, and 6 miles high. And every 100 years, a bird flies over the mountain with a silk scarf in its beak and runs the scarf over the top of the mountain once. In the length of time it would take for the silk scarf to wear away the mountain, that's how long you've been doing it. See, doesn't it change the meaning of this life? It's like, oh, there it goes. I feel like one of those little bugs that's born in the morning and dies at noon, you know, lives till sunset, and around noon says, boy, this is life. Sure.
Where it appeared that there was a conscious awareness of a higher power, of the nature of a higher power, acting directly in your life, and if you had that experience, or seemed to have that experience, how you integrated that into your current feeling with regard to spiritual matters?
To repeat what he said. He said, have you ever met anybody out there? Did you believe it? How has it changed your life? Basically, is what he's asking me. And, you're like a shill, because my whole life is based on, my basic practice, see this I don't push in the West, because people in the West don't really understand it. My basic practice is what's called Guru Kripa, or the grace of the Guru. It involves a relationship. In India, they say God, Guru, and Self are one and the same thing. And you can go there through God, through going inward to the deepest truth of your being, or through another being as a door frame through which you see the truth through them. It's not them, they're just a doorway through which you see. And that's called the Guru, and it's not really understood in the West, so I don't use it much. But my Guru dropped his body in 73. And for the last 23 years, he has continued to be the most important force in my life and the most real relationship I have. Now, what do I mean by that? It is not like I sit down and he sits down and we talk and he says, I'm dead and I know you're not, but I want to tell you, next Tuesday, don't do that or something like that. It's not that level at all. That he and I met in a place of such depth of our being that is the place that continues to live. Now I can feel the presence of that space. And at first I identify that presence with the stories and the memories I had of him and all the pictures. And I've done books about all this and all that stuff. And then as time went on, the books and the pictures ceased to do it for me anymore. And then what I was with were the qualities of being. I was with rascality, or I was with emptiness, or I was with compassion, or I was with fierceness or tenderness, or that's what the qualities. I felt I was with him through qualities. And they guided me. There would be, I would be doing something and suddenly I would feel like something came in. There would be this quality. And a few times, he actually physically appeared in the room, which is one part of the question you're asking, and was there. And it surprised me and it changed.